And a nod to David Bowie's Space Oddity on this 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission. Welcome to the conversation. We are focusing on the moon today, space science and exploration. 50 years ago today, the crew of Apollo 11 was bound for the moon. Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the lunar surface while Michael Collins remained in orbit in the Apollo command module. Saturday marks 50 years to the day when Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon with language that instantly became famous. There was a lot of memorable sound that week. We wanted to start off this morning with some highlights courtesy of NTD TV.
2, 1, 0, all engines running.
Down 2.5, picking up some dust. 3 feet, 2.5 down. Fake shadow. Four forward, drift into the right a little. 9.5, contact light. Okay, engine stop. Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
I'm at the foot of the ladder. I'm going to step off the limb now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And when Neil Armstrong landed that on the moon, he had less than 30 seconds of fuel left to go. This morning, we're joined by three guests very familiar with the space program, and they span the time and space continuum from experience with Apollo through research looking ahead to the future. Peter McGinnis-Mark is a researcher with the Hawaii Institute of Geophysics and Planetology. He's been at UH Manoa since 1972, and his work is not only in the geology of the moon, but also Mars. He's also director of NASA's Planetary Image Facility at UH Manoa. Klaus Keil is an emeritus professor at UH. His main research focus has been the study of meteorites, but he also conducted studies of the moon during the Apollo program and has worked literally all over the world, from the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry in Germany, UC San Diego, the NASA Ames Research Center, and to UH, among other places. And Lin Jersun is a graduate student at UH Manoa and part of the team about to open up some of the sample tubes of lunar soil for the first time ever. Linger and Pete are here in the studio. Klaus is joining us on the line. And welcome to you all today. I appreciate you being here. We're talking about history, the future, the moon, and beyond. We are also taking your phone calls. If you are calling from Oahu, you can give us a call at 941-3689. Neighbor Islands, 1-877-941-3689. And Professor Keil, I wanted to just start with you as, you know, you worked on all the Apollo missions in this sort of season of remembrance that we're in right now. What comes to mind for you?
Well, my most important memory is that I had serious doubts if we could actually achieve the bold goal that the President John F. Kennedy had set for the nation on May 25th, 61. You may remember that at a joint session of the Congress, he was saying, "I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieve the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to Earth." And this was an extremely bold challenge to the nation because so many things had to be done. The Saturn V rockets had to be developed. The astronauts had to be trained, and even trivial things like the surface of the moon was basically unknown. We really didn't know very much about what the surface was like. In fact, some scientists were saying, if you land on the moon, you sink in the dust and disappear. And so the United States had first to develop unmanned programs, notably the Ranger program, to explore the surface of the moon. And the depressing thing was that the first six Rangers from 1961 to 64 were unsuccessful. and some could not even find the moon. Can you imagine that? And here the president wanted to send men to the moon within the next 5 years and bring them back. And so this worried me greatly, and I think I wasn't the only one. A lot of people had their worries, and it is to the credit of the nation that this goal was achieved. It's without any doubt the greatest scientific and engineering achievement of the past century.
And Pete McGinnis-Mark, you were a college student at the time.
That's right, yeah. I, point of correction, I arrived at UH Monroe in 1982. And morning, Klaus.
Good morning, Klaus and I were colleagues.
And yeah, I was an undergraduate student still in England during the Apollo program. So my advisor got me to do classwork in terms of trying to figure out where the Apollo astronauts were and what kind of geology they were seeing. So I was glued to a radio in London, middle of the night, with maps of the moon, trying to figure out where they were.
And
so, good
and
fun.
How important was the Apollo, not just Apollo 11, but the Apollo missions themselves to the arc of your career and curiosity and inspirational, aspirational aspects?
To my own career, it was fundamental because for the first time I actually combined geology with parts of astronomy and a technique called remote sensing, where you look at, say, the surface of a planet in completely different wavelengths of light. So that combination inspired me to go on to graduate school, where I got subverted to look at Mars. But the Apollo program as a whole, it's just so inspiring. I remember, you know, Sputnik 1 and in 57 and Gagarin going up in 61, and I never thought that I would be following people's exploits as a scientific career sort of thing, but really influential.
And Lingerson, I'm not going to ask you for personal memories because you came a bit later, but in terms of the, I guess, the aspirational and inspirational part of this that lives on, and you're about to embark on another round of research connected with the Apollo missions. Tell us about that.
So, JSC, the Johnson Space Center, are going to open two Apollo 17 tubes. They've been like storage and frozen since they come back. And this year, because it's a 50 years anniversary, they're going to open these two tubes. So it's a great teamwork thing. And I'm part of this. I feel like very honored. And part of my work is to scan the tube, like layer by layer, with an spectrometer, and to get the spectra of the spectral images of the surface and analyze its mineralogy, elements, and water abundances.
And this is sort of a, if not a core sample, but sort of going down into the soil of the moon. This is from Apollo 17, the last crewed lunar mission in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
Then, so it's not just sort of moon rocks from the surface. It goes down in terms of the...
Think of it like they investigate Antarctica and they take ice cores.
Right.
So you've got this layer cake
mm-hmm.
within a tube, and that's what Lingxia is going to be looking at, basically seeing earlier parts of the lunar soil that have been buried for billions of years beneath the surface.
You know, one of the interesting things in terms of the study of the moon rocks that came back from that initial, starting with Neil Armstrong and literally a bag of rocks, I guess, coming back, but was not only information about the moon, the history of the moon, but also the history of the Earth.
That's right. And potentially, within lunar soil, you could find pieces of the Earth which were slung onto the lunar surface, again, billions of years ago. But fundamentally, I think Klaus could say that one of the key things the Apollo samples told us was that the moon was formed out of a giant collision very early on in solar system history between an object about the size of Mars and the paleo-Earth, and then the molten material that was slung off accreted or formed into a more solidified lunar surface. Is that correct, Klaus?
That is correct. That's the present main hypothesis on the origin of the moon, and it there are many good reasons why that is correct. But, you know, like in all science, there are some doubters, but I do believe that this is the origin of the moon.
Yeah, and it's so important simply because the Earth's moon is far larger in comparison to its parent planet than any other moon in the solar system. So it was a pressing scientific issue.
Yes.
How did Earth get to have such a large moon, which has influenced the evolution of life on Earth, and it controls the tides, for example, and, you know, it's a really big puzzle.
And Klaus, as this information was coming in sort of in real time and then after the mission itself, what was that like in terms of discovery and perhaps changing past assumptions?
It was like Christmas every day. I mean, in those days, the NASA did not trust the U.S. Post Office, so we all had to fly to Houston and pick up our samples. And some of my colleagues actually showed up with briefcases chained to their wrist. I wasn't going that far. But when I came back to New Mexico at the time, the campus police was there and lights flashing, and we put our samples in our safe. And the next morning, when we first started looking at the soil that we were given, it was very disappointing because we couldn't see a thing. The reason being that there was very fine-grained, I mean nanometer-sized, dark charcoal-like dust covering everything. And we had to wash the samples in acetone to then see the beauty of the lunar samples. And I must tell you, this was an extremely intensive program. I mean, this for me was the highlight of my scientific career, and I'm sure it was for many other people as well. But one of the things that I found so interesting is that we had hardly studied the samples that had come back from Apollo 11. There came Apollo 12, and then Apollo 14, and then Apollo 15, and so forth. And we worked like we've never worked before. So it was a very exciting day. And every day we looked at the samples, we found something new. As you may remember, we found new minerals that do not exist on the Earth, like amalcolite, at least at the time didn't exist on the Earth, which we named after Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins, and other phases as well. So there was a surprise every day. It was the most exciting time in my scientific career.
And Pete, this was a very compressed period. Again, people forget sometimes. This is 1969 to 1972.
That is correct, and there were six successful Apollo landings within a period of like just under 3.5 years. And as Klaus says, you know, a lot of samples, they were bringing back over 350 kilograms of lunar samples. And as Linja is doing, you know, you can spend a graduate career studying 2 or 3 grams.
So yeah, in fact, if I may interject, the total amount of material, Bill, that the Apollo astronauts returned from the moon was 382 kilograms. And we built a facility, lunar vault, pristine lunar vault, where the samples could be retained in a pristine state. And of those 382 kilograms, 317 kilograms are still pristine as they were on the moon. And that is very important because over the years since these landings, new people with new analytical tools and better analytical tools have continued to study this material, and it was very important that pristine lunar material was preserved and is still preserved.
But Klaus, you want to make the point that even though we've got so much pristine material, that comes from a relatively small part of the moon. So we need to go back and get more rocks.
Yes.
Well,
yeah.
And
we have a little advantage in that impacts on the moon, Bill, have blown off hundreds of meteorites, lunar rocks. Of course, these impacts are at random and are not at the Apollo sites. So we know we have material from all over the moon, but we don't know exactly where they came from. And Peter's correct. The future missions to the moon will go to areas that we haven't seen before, and particularly study material from great depth, which will tell us about the evolution of the moon.
Let's talk a little bit about these future missions and updating. For example, most recently, China earlier this year in January made the first landing on the far side of the moon. India earlier this week scrapped a mission less than an hour before liftoff. Now they're saying they're going to relaunch next week an uncrewed mission heading for the south pole of the moon, which is an area that is less explored. And the emphasis here again, soil analysis. So, Linger, as you look into the core samples that you'll be seeing, what will you be looking for? What will excite you about that process?
Well, one thing is, since we have the samples, they can provide ground truth for me because my major is lunar remote sensing, because we can only collect samples from very limited locations, even though they can explore this area. Like for the Apollo 17, they've been like 30 kilometers in that Taro's littoral region. Mm-hmm. But still, compared to the whole moon, it's still a tiny spot. So if we have more sample coming from like more locations, right, and we can take use of that sample and combine remote sensing methods, such as the global spectral map, to develop a global mineralogy or rock type map or iron map or titanium map.
To show where
think of it as
different minerals
the field data, i.e. the rocks coming back, are the calibration points for our global mapping. And partly in Hawaii and elsewhere on the mainland, they've developed techniques where from orbit you can get relative abundances of many minerals, but it really is nice to know you've got it right in a few key locations. And as Klaus said, we want to go to many other parts of the moon, partly because they're different ages and partly because the chemistry is different.
If you're just joining the conversation, we're talking about the moon, Apollo 11's mission 50 years ago this week, future of space exploration, space science. We'd like to know what you think. Any memories of the moon landing for you? You can give us a call. Join the discussion, 941-3689 here on Oahu. Neighbor Islands, toll-free, 877-941-3689. Our guests in studio, Peter McGinnis-Mark, researcher at the Hawaii Institute of Geophysics and Planetology, Lingzhi Sun, part of the research team about to open sample tubes of lunar soil from Apollo 17. And joining us on the line is Klaus Keil, involved in a number of experiments during the Apollo program.
Yeah, I should add to what Sun said. The lunar samples are also a measure of the history of our star, the Sun, because the Moon does not have an atmosphere, so the radiation that comes from the Sun is implanted into these minerals. And if you look at a core tube, you can figure out, for example, how the Sun changed over millions or billions of years, if it actually did. And so this is very important that one looks at core samples as well.
You know, apart from the moon mission itself, but related to research in that, this program today about the Apollo mission and space exploration, but we can't really ignore what's going on this week with protests on Mauna Kea, the construction of the 30-meter telescope. Pete, what's your perspective on that?
I'm very much conflicted because, you know, I recognize that the Hawaii community, Mauna Kea is a sacred site, and I really love Hawaii. I've been here 37 years and will never leave, I think. Against that, the 30-meter telescope will be the next step forward. It will continue Hawaii as the world leader in astronomical observations. It's different having a ground-based telescope compared to an orbital telescope like the Hubble. A ground-based instrument like TMT would let us see far back in time because it sees much greater distances. So it comes down, I think, to does Hawaii want to remain a world leader in some scientific exploit? How much do we make allowances for legitimate issues with the Hawaiian community? If they see it as sacred ground, then I respect that point of view. The only thing I would add is that because of the state Supreme Court's ruling that the TMT can proceed, that is the law of the land. And some compromise has to be found, but Hawaii is unique in terms of the Northern Hemisphere, in terms of what part of the sky it can see. And for the last 30 years, people from around the world come to Hawaii and work with our instruments. It's, you know, one of the unsung stars of, and no pun intended, stars of what Hawaii's industry is like. If we're trying to diversify our economy, high tech like astronomy is the way to go because it's not environmentally polluting and it pays a lot of people a lot of good money, and trying to train our kids to stay in the state, this is one way to do it.
Talking about space science, space research, Apollo 11 mission 50 years ago this week, future of space exploration and science. Love to know what you think. You can call in at 941-3689 if you're calling from Oahu. Neighbor Islands, 1-877-941-3689. And Klaus, I wanted to ask you about that that element of educational legacy, really. You talked about the period of intensity during the Apollo missions, 69 to 72, but it was sort of the discoveries from that seemed to be a gift that kept on giving for further analysis of advancing the science.
Absolutely. And over the last 50 years, a lot of lunar research has continued on the lunar samples that, as I said earlier, were retained in a pristine state. And I wanted to add something to what Pete said regarding the TMT. You know, I love Hawaii, and I love the Hawaiians, and I admire the Hawaiians, how they came to the Hawaiian Islands. If they actually came from Bora Bora, say, to travel across the Pacific almost all the way to Chile and then turn around on the northern, northeastern trade winds and come to Hawaii required an enormous knowledge of astronomy and celestial mechanics. So the Hawaiian nation has a great tradition in astronomy and in celestial mechanics, and that's something that we should not forget. That the achievements were enormous.
Talking about space science exploration and the also the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission this week. Talking about what gains and Pete, I'm thinking of aspects of space exploration that can be used here on Earth. And climate change is something that just immediately comes to mind as sort of earthly problems that need assistance now. Are there things within the space program that can help teach us things in that direction?
Innumerable things.
Well, if I can say something to that.
Oh, sure.
When the Soviets launched Sputnik 1, this was like a shockwave through the United States and the Western world. And it was clear that the United States particularly would not want to be behind the Soviets and in a big way get into space research. And this required tremendous funding of high schools, universities, emphasis on engineering and science. The entire curriculum at universities has changed as a result of Apollo, and the education of students has changed. So this is just one thing from our point of view as university professors where the impact has been absolutely tremendous. And then, of course, the technical impacts from Earth-crossing satellites, spy satellites to weather satellites to all that. This is all, in a way, a fallout from the Apollo program.
And, of course, you can make the point, Klaus, that even though some of the space missions cost billions of dollars, all that money is spent here down on Earth, and it provides high-paying jobs for everybody, and that the long-term investment in infrastructure is highly important. So space program is expensive, but it's all money spent here.
And we're going to come back. We're going to come back to this theme. We're going to come back to this topic. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, Moon Memories, Moon Thoughts, 50 years after Apollo 11's flight to the moon. Also talking about Hawaii's connection with that history. Guests in the studio, Pete McGinnis-Mark from the Hawaii Institute of Geophysics and Planetology, Ling Shi Sun, part of the research team, about to open sample tubes of lunar soil, and Klaus Keil on the line, involved in a number of experiments during the Apollo program and a long and storied career. You can join us, 1-877-941-3689. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a quick break.
More than 60,000 Americans were forcibly sterilized in the 20th century. How did this happen?
You got rid of the plant that was rotting in the field. You weeded your garden so as to get rid of the kinds of organisms that would ruin the whole plot.
Stories of lives forever changed by the American eugenics movement, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
This evening at 7, right after Says You.
This is Dr. Vivian Tam of Pacific Vision Institute. As I was growing up in the United Kingdom, I was blessed enough to enjoy marvelous public radio. When I moved to Honolulu, I was ecstatic to discover HPR. I started my own ophthalmology practice and have been a corporate sponsor since then. My patients appreciate that I support HPR, and I'm glad that I can do my part.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Welcome back to The Conversation, talking about space this morning, the 50th anniversary week of the Apollo 11 mission and the first crewed space mission on the moon and Neil Armstrong's first steps on the moon. Pete McGinnis, a researcher at the Hawaii Institute of Geophysics and Planetology. And Pete, we were talking just before the break about the applications of space science to earthly issues. In surveys, people will say things like, spending money in space when there are such severe problems on Earth, that's a diversion. How would you respond to that?
Well, primarily, the mindset that we've developed through exploring the planets, not just the moon, but Mars as well, or Venus, to solve some of the problems here on Earth, you're going to need a global perspective that you just can't look at, for example, continental United States and say you know everything that's happening in Australia or in the Arctic or whatever. So space in general provides you with that overview that allows you to look with the same instrument so you have a consistent data set for the entire planet. And then the kinds of techniques which Klaus and his colleagues developed back for the Apollo era and subsequent missions have given us different sets of eyes to look at the Earth, whether it's tracking hurricanes or you're worried about the temperature of the ocean for Hawaii, really important, as well as the storms, but also health of coral reefs, or you're looking at fisheries from space, changes in the Earth's temperature, the atmosphere, as well as the land. You can only make those measurements from space because you wouldn't otherwise know that you're looking at global trends or even regional trends. So the space program as a whole has probably provided vital information for people living here everywhere on the planet Earth in ways which aren't particularly obvious to the general public. But the whole idea of doing space research is to basically understand the way either the Earth works as a planet or the Moon or planets like Mars if we ever get there.
And Linger, as a young graduate student, what brought you into this field of excitement? Again, sometimes we look, oh, it's 50 years ago in terms of the lunar landing, but this is very much in terms of on your mind, in terms of now and looking ahead to the future.
Well, I got involved in planetary science since I was a second grade college student, because it's basically started from a Mars rover picture. Like, when you look at this rover and you're thinking it's working on Mars, like so far away and collecting data and information for us, like, it's part of the curiosity, like, how interesting would that be to study that information on another planet? And that's how it started.
I find Linger's comments really interesting. Hawaii's had a very long history of stellar graduate students. They've built cameras which have flown to Saturn and one in orbit around the Moon right now. So Linger's comments about how the Mars rover pictures inspired her. This is something that UH and other universities on the mainland, but particularly UH, has been very successful with for the last 30 to 40 years, thanks to Klaus's leadership as former director of the Institute. You know, we have people who graduated from our programs who are flying missions to other planets, as well as doing a lot of good work from satellites orbiting the Earth. So her comments is just the current version of how many of our former students have benefited from the world-class education they get here at UH Manoa.
That educational legacy lingering in a lot of fields, again, the return back to problems on Earth or challenges on Earth. The Trump administration has plans, wants to return to the Moon by 2024. Use that as a stepping stone to a Mars mission. Pete, I may be asking the choir on this, but how do you feel about that?
To be polite, I haven't read his latest tweet. He has varying ideas about what the strategy should be, and I believe tomorrow, July 19th, he's giving a keynote statement on what the U.S. should be doing with space exploration, but the Chinese are doing fabulous things, going back to the Moon.
Thanks.
And, you know, what Linger's senior colleagues can do in China, go landing on the far side of the Moon. And one of the plans is to return samples from the far side of the Moon. It's incredible technologically. So if the U.S. doesn't buck up its ideas, and either it's going to be NASA or it could be the commercial endeavors, we're going to be left behind. China is serious about getting to the Moon, right, Linger?
Yes, and I read a recent news says China going to combine AI technology to collect sample from the far side of the Moon.
Mm. Artificial intelligence playing a role in space exploration and space science as well. You know, we had a caller on the line before, I think, who may have dropped out or is still with us. Go ahead. Cecil.
Oh, aloha. I'm sorry. Yes, I'm on the Big Island. I had a comment regarding the, or wanted you to comment, rather, on the energy requirement for the Moon. There's the something commonly referred to as the dreaded lunar night, and a small team here of inventors and dreamers has developed something that utilizes a solution to the Kessler syndrome so that we can create a radiation-free cubic meter volume in low Earth orbit that produces super products and pays for Olympus, which is a space station at L1. Now, your guests are going to understand that Lagrange Point 1 is an unstable place for a space platform, but our team has solved that problem, and all we need is sunlight in order to maintain a position 1 meter within 1 meter.
So Cecil, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. I appreciate that. But Peter, what about that?
Cecil, a very interesting question. I think part of it relates to if we were going to go back to the moon and you've got to have something on the surface for a long period of time, the power or the energy that you need to survive the lunar night, and our listeners may not know, but the moon rotates once every 27 days approximately. So it has nearly 2 weeks of nighttime where it gets really, really cold. And yeah. So finding like alternative ways to provide the energy, and this platform at the L1 or Lagrangian 1 point where you could actually perhaps microwave power down to something on the surface, that out-of-the-box thinking is one thing we have to do, that you're developing new ideas and new technologies. Again, we could be a leader in this sort of thing, but certainly it's a good point that any long-duration lunar mission is going to have to survive 14 days of very cold.
And Klaus, let me go back to you on this, that what Peter's talking about, that out-of-the-box thinking, that is so much a part of the U.S. space program. I'm thinking of for a lot of Americans and a lot of folks, this comes down in terms of movies. I mean, I'm thinking of Apollo 13 and sort of facing the crisis, adapting to that, the ingenuity on the fly. Any thoughts or memories in your area on that?
Yeah, I remember I was in Bern, Switzerland at the time giving some talks when this disaster with Apollo 13 happened. And to me, this is one of the greatest achievements that the engineers in Houston have had, that is what it was possible to make sure they could develop with whatever was lying around in the spacecraft, almost, to build devices that could provide oxygen, that could absorb the carbon dioxide, which was all very, very dangerous. So this was an unbelievable achievement, and it is ingenuity. There is no question about it. The whole Apollo program was full of individuals who were geniuses, and many of them were young people. I remember that when I was at NASA Ames, so many of the people that were working in preparing for the lunar landing were young guys, and there was that spirit that I wish we would have again in the nation, the spirit of exploring and wanting to do great things. I mean, the fact that we were able to reunite or to unite the entire population and the scientific community by and large behind the idea of going to the moon is one of the great achievements, political achievements and social achievements. And it shows you that if a country like the U.S. puts its mind to solving a technological engineering type problem, it can be done. Social problems, much more difficult. But engineering and scientific problems, a country can do. And as I said, we were all very young in those days. I mean, I was 34 at the time.
Well, that's all right. We have Linger here in terms of a representative of younger folks. And I noticed you nodding your head on some of that, that the aspirational aspect of that being very important.
Yes, it is.
The idea, you know, we were talking about challenges, by the way, in terms of things faced in the context of Apollo 13. We had a caller who I think dropped out but wanted to know about another challenge that exists these days, which is space debris, the idea of things that are out there because so much hardware has been put up in space. Pete, any thoughts on that?
Well, it will certainly become a problem. Space debris, everybody may have seen the movie Gravity, for example, mm-hmm. will be aware that anything from a small flake of paint to, say, a screwdriver that an astronaut has dropped from the space station, It's traveling very fast, about 17,000 miles an hour, and if it hits a spacecraft, that's a problem. The space debris is primarily in the altitudes of where most of our spacecraft fly. There are sweet spots, roughly between, say, 240 and 700 miles above the Earth's surface. So that is where most of the space junk lies at the moment, and there's probably tens of thousands of very small pieces which the US Air Force tracks with radar. The problem will become worse as we start getting these constellations of communication satellites to like provide the internet to the globe, basically, on a very cheap basis, where you're launching thousands of small satellites. Christopher Phillips actually mentioned this on one of the earlier shows, that you're going to see far more spacecraft, smaller spacecraft, which are less reliable, which means you can't control them so well. So they may be tumbling into different orbits. Space debris will become an increasing problem. I don't think it will get as bad as the movie WALL-E suggested, for example, but it's still going to be something which I think we'll have to start thinking seriously about. How do you remove that kind of debris on timescales that will not impact the spacecraft, which we are relying on for everything from GPS to weather to monitoring the oceans and the atmosphere.
And that development that you mentioned as well in terms of space launches with nanosatellites, the very
right.
small satellites going
yes.
up and increasing with that also has become very much of an international market. I mean, certainly China's
sure.
involved in that. India's deeply
involved
in that.
And in fact, UH is developing its own capability to build and launch its own rockets and small satellites. UH will get around that problem because we'll only put our spacecraft at a low enough altitude that the atmosphere will bring them back down after a few years. But yes, internationally, and if you militarize space where you're actually intending to harm foreign countries' assets, you're bound to have accidents. You're bound to shower debris in these certain key orbits, which will become a hazard perhaps for hundreds of years.
We have a caller who a shy caller who wanted to ask about from Waikiki. The original moon landing was completed in what is nowadays a minuscule level of processing power. How do guests feel about the capabilities of moon travel with modern technology? And how about that? And Klaus, let me start with you on that. I mean, never mind smartphones. The computing power back in 1969 was another matter entirely.
Yeah, so what is the question?
So the capabilities of moon travel now with
yeah.
modern technology and with
oh.
that enhanced capacity and capability,
yeah.
and how does that change?
Yeah, or it changed by orders of magnitude. I remember the facilities in Houston, since I was a PI, I was there many times a year. There were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of computers sitting there in mission control, all with tubes, not solid state. And, you can imagine how slow things were. But the spirit, this is what I wanted to say, the spirit in those days amongst people was enormous, entrepreneurial. And let me give you my own example. I had just been 4 years out of East Germany. NASA wanted to employ me as a civil servant on a Naval Air Station, Moffett Field, California, and I wasn't even a citizen. It takes 5 years to become a citizen. And they made that possible. Can you imagine this happening today? I don't think so. So the spirit at the time was enormous, and it overcame all the shortcomings of technology that we have today. So life would be easier today in many ways with the technology that we have.
So not just technology, but also education, that spirit.
Right.
And Linger, in terms of graduate-level work these days in this field, is that What is this spirit of excitement or of interest among colleagues that both here in the United States and China, elsewhere? I know you internationally deal with conferences and research and all of that. What is the spirit like in terms of current generation of researchers?
Well, I feel like it's hard to be represent.
You don't have to represent the entire world on this. Yeah. Yes, but from your perspective, what do you feel?
Yeah, from my perspective, it's interesting. It's mostly start from curiosity. Because I was working on astronomy stuff before, then I found it's not that appealing to me. Then I turned to planetary science. It's just, for me, it's pure curiosity.
And what made the difference between from astronomy to planetary science in particular? What sparked your curiosity to that degree?
I think it's mainly because you are doing something more specific. Like for the moon, you are just looking at the mineralogy or rocks there. But for astronomy, you will have to, they're just so far away compared to.
And trying to get this sort of spirit of exploration and just intrigue, that's one of the real challenges that, you know, we have a whole series of high school or middle school activities here in Hawaii which do rocketry. And through like Windward Community College's Apollo celebration on this coming Saturday, trying to get undergraduate students involved. But Lingzhou provides a great example of how do you actually get this excitement into the next generation of space scientists that Klaus just mentioned, for example. You know, it's really tough to get someone who will have a personal engagement either in the return to the moon or exploring Mars or even flying satellites in Earth orbit. So I just want to make a plug again. This is one of the key things that UH Manoa is world renowned for, is getting graduate students like Lingzhou into positions where they actually build instruments, they fly spacecraft, they do the detailed technical work. But it's a challenge to get this excitement carrying forward. Klaus had it easy back in the 60s. It's much more difficult in the 2020s.
You know, it's interesting also because you point out that, and Lingzhou, you mentioned this before as well, that there is an intersection of a lot that's not just planetary science. It's applied engineering to the extent of artificial intelligence, robotics, various aspects that really, although they were part of the imagination back in the days of the Apollo program, it's certainly developed in a different way along today.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a sci-fi movie fanatic, and I love movies like Europa Report and The Martian. But it's students like Lingzhou who will actually get inspired and do it for real. And it is engineering, it is computer science, it's life sciences, and it's geology as well as astronomy. It's a really complicated mix to try and give these younger scientists the opportunities, and then they just take off and succeed. It's great.
And Klaus, if I might, when you look at that combination of an educational array that has developed quite a bit since the Apollo days, what is important for you for students to focus on, for people who want to be involved in the cutting edge of science today and tomorrow?
Yeah, they should go to a good university that has a good program, like UH Manoa, HHEP. We have faculty. Students need mentors, and it's very important. I had mentors when I was young, and that was extremely important. Someone who had a lot of experience and could give me new ideas and new thoughts, and I think that is very important when a student decides where to go to school and what to do. If the student can find someone that can serve as a mentor, it's a huge step forward.
And we should mention in terms of this, perhaps less at the graduate school level, but earlier on, Pete, you mentioned that this weekend, Saturday, at Windward Community College, the Apollo Fest,
right,
10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
That is correct. This is run by Joe Ciotti, who was one of our Teacher in Space finalists back for the Challenger days. Joe does a fabulous job out at Windward. And, you know, there's lots of things for families going on, as well as obviously celebrating the Apollo moon landings. They've got the planetarium there and a variety of other space-related activities. So I'm going to be there all day on Saturday, because getting the youngsters really excited about space so that they do think about applying to college and then graduate school to do these hard subjects, which is what is required to actually take the next step back to the moon, onto Mars, and so forth. But Joe's activities, Windward Community College, this coming Saturday, which is, of course, the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing, it's going to be great. So everybody should try and make it there.
Yeah, I should add, it isn't only getting excited about space. It is very important that people that want to work on space issues have a wonderful, strong background in physics, in chemistry, astronomy, geosciences. So the science education of young people is terribly important. And many of our community colleges are doing a good job, as Pete just explained, in that area.
Well, thank you very much to all of you for helping to educate all of us today. Did want to say thank you to our guests here in the studio, Pete McGinnis, Mark.
Pleasure to be here, Bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And Lingxi Sun, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And on the line, Professor Klaus Keil, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Yeah. And we thank you also, listener, for joining us on today's program. If your call didn't make it on the air during today's discussion, you can still contact TalkBack Line and leave your comments. 792-8217, the number for that. Also send us an email, talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can check out the conversation at hawaiipublicradio.org. Catherine Cruz, back tomorrow for more of the conversation.